One, I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Here's the order of the bills we're going to go through today. We're going to start out with Senate Bill 331, then go to Senate Bill 255, Senate Bill 670, Senate Bill 21, 22, and 23. We're going to go in that order, and we'll try to be productive as we go through these six bills. I'd like to start off by opening up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 331. Administrator Lindholm, will you give us a summary?
Certainly. Senate Bill 331 requires the Department of Education to grant a waiver to allow school districts to contract with entities that meet specified criteria for purposes of administering national normed assessments. It directs the Oregon Department of Education to reimburse school district for cost of assessments that are administered under the waiver. Declaring an emergency, it would become effective July 1st, 2011.
Okay. Let me call up John Bridges and Ozzie Rose as our first panel. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, maybe I go first and give you a little background.
Sure.
John, I'll tell you what this is really all about.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I represent the Washington County School Districts. I reside here in Salem, and I'm here speaking in favor of Senate Bill 331. As noted by the staff, in 2007, the legislature passed a statute that required the state to enter into an agreement with an entity to administer a nationally normed assessment at grade 10. Local districts could ask for and receive a waiver of the testing mandate for 08-09 if they had administered such a test in 07-08 and the test provider met all the requirements in the legislation. The state provided money for the test that was under their guidance. The districts choosing to seek a waiver had to administer a different test and were required to pay for the test they used. At that time, 13 districts used an alternative test in 07-08 and were eligible for a waiver. 10 of the districts actually applied for the waiver and used an alternative in 08-09. In the 2009 session, the legislature extended the waiver process through 2011 and provided for reimbursement to the districts for the cost of the alternative test. Senate Bill 331 is very simple. It extends the opportunity to get the waiver, makes it permanent. 8 districts will seek a waiver for 2011-2012. These districts will test approximately 7,300 sophomores, or about 16% of the sophomores in our state. The key thing about this discussion, in my view, is of the 8 districts seeking a waiver, one has begun this testing in 05-06, well before the state asked for this kind of testing. They have 6 years of data on their students. One began testing in 06-07, and they have 5 years of data on their students. All the others began testing in 07-08 and now have 4 years of data. And that 07-08 was before the test was required by the state. In addition to testing at grade 10, 6 of the districts, by the way, the alternative test they're all using is called PLAN, and it's a product of the part of the ACT package of assessment. And in addition to doing the grade 10 testing that's required, 6 of the districts test all of their students in grades 8 and 9, and 5 of the districts also administer it to grade 11. So they're using the full assessment program for all their students from one contractor or one testing company. The cost of the test provided by the state contractor is $11.05 per student, and the cost of the test to in the districts using the waiver is $8.72, so it's considerably cheaper than the other test as well. We ask for your support for 331, and now John will share with you information about actually what goes on with the testing and why it's valuable to a school district.
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd like to thank you, Senator Haas and Senator Bonamici, for co-sponsoring Senate Bill 331. You have a copy of the written testimony from the district on how Beaverton is using data from the plan to place students in more rigorous coursework, including advanced placement and international baccalaureate courses, as well as identifying individual students that need additional academic support or more intensive mentoring and guidance. We've used that data, as Ozzy mentioned, over the past 6 years to assess our progress in closing the achievement gap that is in our district as well as districts nationwide, and increase the success of students as they transition from middle school to high school. So we do use the full battery of tests, and our eighth grade students take the Explore in the middle of their eighth grade year. That helps their counselors and teachers forecast them into high school coursework that prepare them for college and career readiness. We've used the data to evaluate the effectiveness of our instructional programs. You have an example from the science program evaluation. Science is a component that students are tested on, and we receive data on that would not be available on the other test. And we also receive data on whether students are college and career ready. Finally, the last two areas have been developed in the last 2 years. One is identifying college readiness benchmarks for students in grades 3 through 8. As you may be aware, the state has raised the mathematics achievement standards for students in grades 3 through 8 on the state test, and the state board is in the process of doing that for the state reading test. We kind of jumped ahead of that and said we know that the current state benchmarks were not giving students and parents information about whether they were meeting college and career readiness expectations, as that is our district goal, to graduate all students college and career ready. So using the plan data that we had for a number of years, we were able to look at what score on the state test would predict if a student was on a trajectory to be college and career ready. And you have that, those scores that we've identified as a district, and we've communicated to parents this fall in terms of our expectations for students to be college and career ready in grades 3 through 8. And finally, we've developed an individual student growth model for all students in grades 3 through 11. And in the written testimony, there's an excerpt of what we're doing at high school, which is adopting the ACT growth model. A big interest of parents in our district is for students that are meeting college and career readiness, are they growing enough? Are they making progress as they move from grade 8 through grade 12? So using the ACT growth model, we've set goals for every student, whether they're below college and career readiness, close to that mark, or they're well above college and career readiness, and said, we have adopted these targets for you. This is how we want to see you grow in preparation for your next step. And we're able to put our data side by side with the national sample. Appreciate your support of Senate Bill 331. We think it's the right thing to do. The alternatives for us are either to stop giving the plan at 10th grade and do the state-adopted test, or we would do dual testing of students, and we don't think that in this time that's a wise use of student resources. So thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, John. So you like the tests, period. Because of all of the things you cited, and it happens to be cheaper.
That's correct.
Incidentally. Committee, you also have a testimony from Sean Wilkinson, the superintendent of the Van Lapine School District, supporting this bill. Any other questions, Suzanne, Senator Bonamici?
I'm convinced, Mr. Chair.
If it'd be helpful, I at least give you the list of who else is involved in this. If you're,
I think that would be helpful.
Beaverton, Tigard, Tualatin, Ben Lapine, and you've got testimony of them today. Tigard was going to be here and couldn't. Eugene, Grants Pass, Monroe, Sherwood, and Forest Grove.
The senator from Sherwood has a question.
Ozzy, I'm trying to remember back in this debate. Does this interfere with any contracts that the state has with any other test provider that the state has?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, no, sir. An RFP was put out, a different vendor was selected. The state entered into a contract with them for a six-year period, which ends in three more years. But the state, it has an opt-out clause with 30 days notice, et cetera. You passed the exemption or waiver process and then extended it, and there's been no contractual no contractual issues with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I see no further comments or questions. Anybody else signed up to testify or be heard on this measure? I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 331 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 331. Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 331 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Bonamici, would you be so kind to carry this
bill? I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 331. And I would like to open up now a public hearing and possible work session. I'm sorry, a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 255.
Senate Bill 255 modifies the contents of and process for proposal to establish charter schools, a public charter school. It modifies processes for renewal and termination of a charter school for a public charter school and clarifies the list of laws that apply to public charter schools.
All right, we have some people we'd like to call forward here. Senator Bonamici, do you want to start us off?
I would. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You read my mind. Mr. Chair, this is a bill that came out of an interim work group, the Charter Review, I think we called it a committee, or Ten-Year Charter Review Committee. And the committee was put together recognizing that it had been 10 years since the original charter school legislation had passed. There was a sort of consensus that we needed to review the statute and make sure that things were working as intended and properly. And so we had several meetings, and I know the chair of the committee is here and other committee members are here who can tell you the details, but we had many meetings, all excellent discussions with everyone around the table, and the meetings were run very well. And what we agreed to do, Mr. Chair, is to run, and committee members, is to move forward on an issue if we had consensus. And so there were several things that were discussed that we did not include in the bill. The bill is a consensus bill. The people who attended the committee and were members of the committee, I believe, will agree that this bill is a consensus bill. And you can see who was on the committee when you look at the last page of Lori Satin-Spiel's testimony. She submitted the committee report from the committee. So this, I believe, Mr. Chair and committee, that this bill updates the statute. It makes some needed changes that will make the statute work more effectively and efficiently, and look forward to the testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So let's call Lori Satin-Spiel up, along with Bobby Reagan from the Portland School Board.
Cindy Hunt. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Lori Satin-Spiel for the Oregon School Boards. And thank you, Senator Bonamici, for that introduction. And with that, I'd also like to thank our other legislative representative, co-speaker Roblin, who also was a part of this work group. And finally, after 9 months of work, and all the mothers here who have children, 9 months of work, here we go. Senate Bill 255, and as Senator Bonamici mentioned, charter law has been in place for over 10 years. And given the amount of folks that were on the committee that you've got a record of, and I also attached the supplemental list, lots of interest throughout this committee's meetings and what was going on, and folks wanting to provide input. So what I have is a supplemental list of folks who attended meetings, and some of them gave input as well, and those names are also there. today, OEA and PTA have also submitted written or will submit written testimony as a part of the group, but for time constraints, they opted to be supportive with a letter. As Senator Bonamici also mentioned, charter law has been in place, and I think for us, the charter school growth was far exceeded when the law went into place. I think that we talked about successes, maybe 20 charter schools, and after 10 years, we've got over 100 and 18,000 students. So we see that as a success. And, you know, today we still have many districts that don't have charter schools or have not seen an application. And then we've got rural districts who have one school that provides education from K through 12 who have turned into a charter district or a single school district. And then we have Portland Public School on the other spectrum who has had 30 applications, 10 in the past 10 years, and currently have 7 that they sponsor, soon to be 9. And then 2 of their sponsorships are also in place by the State Board of Education, and that Portland still works with those schools. So at the 10-year anniversary, OSBA continued to have questions about the law and applications, even from charter developers who we also work with as well. And we said it made this law as time to be looked at. Let's have a discussion. Our first meeting, we talked about what the charge of the group was, what's the outcome, what's the goal. And Chair Regan, who did a great job in facilitating, it's to have the discussion. You know, I know the questions from the field, what works, what doesn't, and what can we do about them. And so this is the product of that discussion, and as also mentioned, a consensus document, and I'm going to turn it to Bobby to go through the document with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bobby Regan, and I'm a member of the Portland School Board. As chair of the 10-year Charter Review Committee, I want to start by, first of all, thanking OSBA and particularly Lori Satinspiel for bringing the group together. And I also want to thank all of the participants of the committee. We met together for 9 months and developed a legislative concept, which is now SB 255. Anything that landed in this bill did so via unanimous consent of the group, which gives us all great hope for passage. We also finalized a committee report, which includes a summary of the bigger issues we discussed, issues we intentionally chose not to discuss, and a highlight of areas where there was strong but not always unanimous agreement. You have a copy of that in your packet, and I encourage you to look at that as well. Briefly, what we didn't do was to take up issues around online or virtual charter schools, since the legislature looked at this via a statewide online learning task force, which I participated in and 6 legislators participated in 2009. Another issue we didn't look at is how charter schools are doing in terms of student achievement, which of course is the most important issue. We recommended a full-blown review be done comparing student achievement to see how charter schools do compared to traditional public schools. We didn't believe that we could actually fully address that in our 9 meetings. The Charter Review Committee also reached general consensus on some topics without agreeing on specific remedies, so these didn't end up in 255, but were part of our report. For example, the group discussed at length the rationale for charter school funding, which is set at 80%, 90%, or 95% of the state's per pupil funding, depending on grades served or whether the charter school is district or state sponsored. There was strong consensus that it would make sense to have the state sponsored rate be identical to whatever the district sponsored rates are going forward. There was also discussion of having just one rate, but no agreement on what the rate should be. I'm sure you'll all be surprised that we all agreed that public school need to be funded in a stable and adequate manner. The committee spent considerable time discussing the issues of small, single-school school districts that convert to charter status, which is a development that's exclusive to Oregon. We also discussed the general application process and whether charter applicants should spell out how they are innovative and how the curriculum compares with the school districts the schools currently served by that school district. And we discussed the difficulties in applying the state's charter school law to special education students when the student is a resident of one district but attends a charter school in another. Looking at what's best for students, the Charter Review Committee supports having residency transfer to the district where the charter school is sponsored and operates. Again, we encourage you to read the full report. So SB 255. It includes recommendations that are generally designed to clarify procedures for public school districts, charter applicants, and charter schools. The recommendations technically are amendments to ORS 338. All nine of the recommendations made it into this bill, again, were made with unanimous consent of the 10-year Charter School Review Committee, which represented pretty much every side of the issue. So here's where we landed. SB 255 would establish that an elected school board member could not simultaneously serve on a district-sponsored charter school board of directors. So that was, you know, clearly trying to avoid potential conflicts of interest. It would require that an application for a public charter school be submitted by a date identified by the school district board and would have to be at least 180 days before the charter school would begin operating. So here I think there was a recognition that it's very difficult to start a school and it's in everyone's best interest to have the time to do so. SB 255 would allow a school district board to require an applicant to submit a letter of intent that they're going to apply. And again, this simply just helps school districts in terms of planning and staffing for the review of the application. It would require members of a charter school governing body to acknowledge an understanding of the fiduciary responsibilities of serving on the board. And here we recognize that some charter schools are started or initiated by very passionate teachers, very passionate educators, passionate parents. We want to also make sure that they understand what the fiduciary responsibilities are of actually serving in a board capacity. SB 255 establishes the requirements for a complete proposal and provides timelines and an appeals process so an application is not held in limbo based on questions of completeness, and that's an issue that has been experienced by several charter schools and school districts. It requires the school district board to review an application based on the adequacy of the information provided, and here we are trying to put a greater emphasis on the quality of the information rather than the quantity. So if you can say it in 50 pages in a credible way, that's as good or better than saying it in 500 pages. It limits the review of an appeal by the State Board of Education to only the reasons stated by the school district board. So in the past, the Oregon Department of Ed would essentially look at an application that had been denied at the school district level as a new application rather than looking at why the school board denied. SB 255 allows a school board or an applicant to request mediation by the state board if the parties are unable to reach an agreement on a substantive change to a charter school contract. So here what we're talking about is if you have a school board that approves an application or a renewal, and then the charter or the school district decides on a substantive change, sometimes they get stuck prior to signing a contract, and so we have a review process to get them out of that stuck spot. And then finally, SB 255 reorganizes and expands the list of laws that apply to public charter schools. So as I wrap up, I want to say that facilitating the statewide committee was a great experience, and our work product is strong. I want to especially thank Senator Suzanne Bonamici and co-speaker Arnie Roblin for their work throughout with our group. And given that the contents of the bill were agreed to by all parties, we look forward to speedy consideration and passage. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Cindy Hunt, and I'm here from the Oregon Department of Education to testify in support of this bill. I was also the Department of Education's representative on the committee that met for 9 months. I also was around when the original charter school bill was created. So I have a bit of a history with charter schools. One of the things I'd like to echo that I think has already been said is our appreciation for the OSBA for pulling this group together. I also served on the Online Learning Task Force, and many task force members expressed a desire to look over and review charter school law, and OSBA stepped up to the plate and facilitated that. We also, as we know, charter school issues can be very contentious sometimes, and a lot of the debate and discussion in the group was quite robust, to be honest, and I appreciate that too, you know, and because I think that it adds to the eventual product that is here before you. These issues have been discussed. These issues, it was a unanimous consent to have these provisions in the bill. And Another piece, I'm going to keep my testimony today very short, but a couple of pieces that the work group discussed that lent itself to ODE's work is that I know that Bobby mentioned around student achievement being very important, reviewing that. We couldn't get to that in the work group. One of the things that the department has added to its new federal charter school grant is a student achievement piece, so that we will be tracking things like in subgroups, including rural students, students with disabilities, English learners, and high poverty students, and being able to compare those subgroups and the student achievement of charter schools to other schools and being able to publish that to the public and to those schools. So that's a component, like I said, of the new federal grant moving forward, and part of this work helped to inform that. Another piece, I think you heard Lori talk about the phenomenon of these single schools that are in our small rural school districts across the state. I think we have something like 15 of these schools and counting. This is kind of a uniquely Oregon thing. And these folks, they have a lot of questions because they don't quite fit in as a school district, and they kind of, you know, don't fit with the rest of the charter schools. So last week, the department and OSBA and the Umatillamaro ESD conducted a seminar over in Eastern Oregon for these schools because there's a large number of them up in our northeastern corner of the state, and answered questions, provided technical assistance, and so that was a good partnership that was a result of the work here. So I wanted to highlight some of those issues that aren't specifically in the bill but were a result of the committee work. And with that, if you have any specific questions about the provisions of the bill, I'm happy to answer those.
Specific questions only, not general questions. Thank you all for your work. Senator Morrison.
Thank you. In the 10-year history of charter schools, have we done any measurement comparative to the success of those students versus the general population?
Yeah. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Morse, we do have some student achievement data in that these students are required to take the statewide assessment. They're required to meet AYP. So we do have some student achievement data, and I could provide some of that to you. I don't have it with me today.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just curious if we're on track, below, or above. Do we have a sense of the performance of these schools?
Yeah, Chair Haas, Senator Morse, some charter schools outperform their peers, and others are not as successful. I guess I'll let the data speak for itself, but I think the answer tends to be more specific to the specific school. As these schools tend to age, I think they become more and more successful. For example, the State Board, I think you heard, sponsors three schools, and we have a fourth one opening in the fall. But one of our schools has been open for 6 years. There was a point during that 6-year period where it wasn't meeting AYP, and it stepped up to the plate, used federal funds, targeted students, and this year it's back on track. Now, that's a school with a lot of experience. When they had an issue, they faced it, and the State Board just renewed their charter for another 10 years because they were successful, and because when they had challenges that faced them, they addressed them. But I can provide you the data so you can look statewide and draw your conclusions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to especially thank Cindy for her wealth of knowledge. It was very useful to have her her history because she was there when the original charter school bill passed. I also would be interested in looking at more information about achievement. I just encourage us to be very careful about making sure that we're comparing students from like socioeconomic backgrounds and that sort of thing, so we know that we're really getting meaningful comparisons. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you. The OSBA. Karin Hikas, Ron Brain. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas, members of the committee. My name is Karin Hikas, and I'm the director of the Northwest Center for Educational Options, which is Oregon's state charter school association. About 80% of the charter schools in the state are members of our organization, so we're here representing them today.
Mr. Chairman Haas, members of the committee, my name is Ron Bryan. I'm from Roseburg, Oregon. I'm the director of Phoenix Charter School. We serve approximately an enrollment of about 200 at-risk students in Douglas County. The first of all, the experience with the OSBA task force, I was a member, was a good one. I heard testimony already about robust discussions. I thought they were very healthy discussions. But the scope of the committee, of course, there's so much to do and so little time. And so that's why the focus, I think, with Senate Bill 255 is basically on the process of establishing and renewing a charter. And not a lot of recommendations that go beyond that. And I think you've heard testimony already of some areas of interest. I think that one of the things that came up was just best practices. There are a lot of good relationships out there among sponsors and charters that are really doing great things for kids and bringing those to the forefront. My own superintendent in the sponsoring district really asked me, I asked him, well, what's the one thing you want messaged to the task force? He said, if there are things that charter schools are able to do that are also good for regular public schools, we'd like those to extend to public schools, regular public schools. And he felt that was part of the 10-year experiment, was kind of the research and development portion of what charter schools are. If there are things that are promising for all kids, let's extend those to other schools as well. I think that another issue is there are many issues, I think, of concern to charter students, parents, and charter schools themselves that were really not on the agenda either. And so the one thing I would urge is just that ability to keep working on these issues. In regards to earlier testimony, Chairman Haas and Member Morris, I think in terms of achievement, one of the things I would urge to look at is the student. So we met AYP only 1 year, but we have at-risk kids, indeed high-risk kids. And so they come to us 4.5 years behind grade level in reading, 4.75 years, this is the median score, behind in math, and sometimes they're tested that same year. This year we have 80 students, 84 seniors, 43 of those are new to us this year. And so it's difficult and to have just 1 or 2 years to really turn things around quickly. But what I can say is that having this option, we have a lot of kids that find success at our school and do so much better, do go on to graduate. This year, I'm proud to say, we have 51% of last year's graduating class actually taking classes at Umpqua Community College. That's a huge turnaround for us. So, again, in previous testimony, it noted how long it takes for a new school. Research suggests at least 5 to 6 years before they really come up to a high performance level. It takes that long to create the school. And indeed, what we're doing with charter schools many times is not just creating a school. It's a school system that we're creating, especially those of private nonprofits that are essentially standalone systems. So we appreciate your support and the work of this committee, and I would endorse the changes in this bill.
And I would just like to echo what Ron has shared and what the previous members of the committee shared, that including Senator Bonamici, that this was a large committee. How many people did we have? 25 people or something? It was a large committee. So every stakeholder represented, anyone who has a stake in the charter school field really was represented. And so we had a wide range of perspectives and information, and it was a very just a unique opportunity for us to share with each other our different viewpoints, the different information and data points that we all had that we could bring and share to inform each other and educate each other, and a lot of excellent conversations. I think that everyone around the table would like to see the charter school law changed. I think that there are a lot of ways that we would like to change the law that that we don't agree on. I mean, this bill represents what we can agree on. I don't think this bill represents anyone's top priorities for how to change charter law. And I'm being a little facetious, but I'm fairly sure it doesn't. But that's okay, because this bill is what it is. It is where we found agreement amongst a broad group of stakeholders, where we could clarify laws that needed to be clarified, where we could clarify processes that needed to be clarified, and that's a great thing, you know, where we can come together and find consensus from all sides of the issue. We really appreciate that opportunity, and our organization always looks for ways to collaborate with everyone involved in this issue and find ways to work together. So we would certainly be interested in doing this again, this interim, and maybe having a different focus this time, but certainly would welcome all of those opportunities. I did want to clarify, too, that the list of laws that apply to charter schools that is in the charter law that we're kind of clarifying, and we're adding the public contracting law and adding the government and ethics standards. Those laws already reference charter schools as having to comply with those laws, and so we're not adding any regulations for charter schools. We're just making sure that it's on the list of applicable laws, because it's one of those places in statute that says nothing applies unless it's on this list. So we want to make sure they're on that list so that folks know up front that they need to comply with public contracting law, that they need to comply with, you know, their government ethics for public officials, that the board members, even though they're of a 501c3, they're considered public officials. The board's considered a public body. We just wanted to make that clear. I also have heard rumors that folks might want to amend this bill, and I guess I would say there are 17 other charter bills in this building that I'm aware of, so clearly there's interest in changing the law. I guess we would say this bill is what it is. It's the result of the consensus of this committee, and so we would not be in favor of amending this bill. We think there are other venues for changing the charter law, but we think since this committee is kind of folded, at least for the time being, we'd like to see this bill remain intact and keep its integrity of the work of this committee. So that's mostly what I have to say, and we would certainly welcome any questions.
Thank you. And we do have an amendment here, but it is destined for another bill here. So that's what that amendment is about.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
I just want to ask you a question about the 43 students who are seniors for the first time. What is the dynamic that has them come to you as opposed to going nowhere or going to a public school?
Often the chairman, the reasons that kids don't make it, the ones that we see predominantly do not have to do with schools. They have to do with life situations and difficulties and how well a school system or someone else can respond to those. Having a designed school for those at-risk, high-risk students is what makes the difference. And so we were an alternative program for many years before changing to charter school and focusing. And what often happens is that these students are dropping out. They'll start at a regular public high school as freshmen, but then drop out for two or three or more years. And then they realize they've been out in the workforce. They realize that they're really not employable. They want to try again. And with today's proficiency requirements for diploma and everything else, it gets very difficult for those students that within just 2 years or 3 years to have enough credits to graduate, to meet those requirements. And what happens is they're starting to get discouraged. It's, I think, an unintended consequence of the federal legislation beginning with No Child Left Behind Act, that the original alternative model was more like a self-contained classroom. Those kids could come in, they weren't, the biggest predictor of success is probably whether they're attached to school or not. And they were not attached to school. So how do you get them attached? With this kind of a self-contained classroom, they became attached to the teacher. They stayed with the same their student group for 4 or 5 periods a day. The teacher became an expert in them, which was more important, especially when you're about 5 years behind grade level than content itself, being a content-based teacher. And so what would happen is over about a year's time, they would become bonded to school. And then you'd see this amazing growth over the next 2 years. And then they'd often rise up to that level and make it. And we've been well supported in our community because of that. Local community sees that. But with a highly qualified requirement, now it's tough to find someone who would have the equivalent of 4 or 5 master's degrees or certifications so that student could stay with them for each of those periods and stay with the same teacher, the same group, for that bonding to take place, for their life problems to begin to be solved so they can really focus and do school. So right now I'm concerned about more avenues for kids to make it because we have fewer. And again, I think it's just an unintended consequence of the law that a lot of the original alt-ed model that was so successful, we were twice named Oregon's Alternative School of the Year. We had one of the highest NCES graduation rates. We're typically around 95-96% graduation rate. We did make AYP satisfactory in 96? No, that's too long ago. I'm confusing the years. 2006, probably. 2008-09, sorry. So we were doing well under this model and had kind of a hybrid model where we could have the alt-ed option. Then when kids were capable of doing the charter model, could move into it. That was very successful. But again, around Oregon, a lot of those alternative situations have been eliminated because districts will be in trouble for not following NCLB if they provide the program in that kind of format.
Okay. Questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and thank you, Karen. Do we have anyone else who hasn't been heard on this?
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 255, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 255.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 255 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 255 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion?
I'd like to thank Senator Bonamici for her efforts. The longer I am down here, the more I see great value in interim work groups and task forces and getting things lined up and refined.
And Mr. Chair, I'd also like to thank, there's other members in the room here who served on the committee, so I'd like to just thank everyone who, it was a lot of time that we spent and some good discussions, and I think this is a good bill, so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, any objections to Senate Bill 255? Seeing none, Senate Bill 255 is passed and heads to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator George, would you like to carry this bill? I close a work session on Senate Bill 255.
And go to the 670.
Yes, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 670.
Senate Bill 670 provides a method of determining type of school where a teacher teaches for purposes of federal loan forgiveness programs offered to teachers. Declaring an emergency, it will become effective upon passage.
Okay, and we have Cindy Hunt here along with two teachers. Jamie Cooper and Stephen Duvall, Senator Bonamici, today is your day. If you want,
I guess so.
Get us going.
Thank you. Wow. Would you like me to make a couple remarks?
Yeah, why don't you?
The issue in this bill came to the attention of the chair and myself and other legislators in the Beaverton district when we were at a legislative breakfast, and we asked if there were concerns that we hadn't already addressed. And at the end of the meeting, somebody said, well, our teachers are very concerned. Some of our teachers are very concerned because they have student loans that were, to their understanding, part of a loan forgiveness program. But when they applied to get the loan forgiveness, they were told that because of the way our school structure is defined in statute, they didn't qualify. It has to do with the definition of secondary school. And so when I made an inquiry to the Department of Education, Cindy responded and said that they would support changing that so the teachers could qualify for the loan forgiveness that they thought they were qualified for when they started teaching. So that's the story, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. So the Federal Student Loan Forgiveness Program, what happens is that Oregon schools are typically divided into three categories, elementary, middle, and secondary. And so that's for various purposes, and sometimes it's just a name, you know, the XYZ middle school. And with the Federal Teacher Loan Forgiveness Program, they divide our schools into elementary and secondary. And if you're a secondary school teacher, you get more loan dollars forgiven than if you're an elementary school teacher. But the definition relies on state law. And we do have state laws, like I said, that talk about middle schools. So one of my jobs at the Oregon Department of Education is I sometimes get the questions that they don't know where to send them. And this was one of them. And over the course of the last couple of years, maybe once or twice a year, I would get a call from a teacher. And they would say, and the most egregious of these calls was that there was one teacher who I believe was teaching in sixth grade. And their school was a middle school, and up until that point, their loan provider had considered them to be a secondary school teacher and was giving them loan forgiveness and so forth. And then their school reorganized, but the person continued teaching the same sixth grade in the same building, but now they were considered an elementary school, and their loan provider said, no, now you're an elementary school teacher, but I'm still a sixth grade teacher, and that hasn't changed. Yeah, but your state law says, you know, so it was very frustrating for this person, as you can imagine, and we didn't have a great answer. So we researched the issue a bit and called the federal government to ask them what was going on with this, and they said, well, your state law, whatever your state law says is what we follow. So when Senator Bonabici contacted us, we were very happy to work with her to define this out specifically for federal student loan forgiveness programs. So the bill is fairly simple. It defines teachers, you know, in grades 6 through 12 as secondary school teachers, and teachers who are in grades kindergarten through grade 5 as elementary school teachers. And it does not impact other federal programs that the department administers or other state programs where we need to divide schools into these various categories. We drew it very narrowly. And it does this at no cost to the state, so it's even better. With that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you to Senator Bonamici for the invitation for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 670. My name is Stephen Duvall, and I teach 8th grade science at Five Oaks Middle School in the Beaverton School District. I was very pleased to hear about the introduction of this bill, as it has the potential to affect teachers at approximately 300 schools across the state. Currently, the Stafford Loan Forgiveness Program, as you probably have already heard, is a financial incentive sponsored by the federal government. As it stands, the program provides financial relief from student loans for teachers that work at Title I or other qualifying high-poverty schools. They would have to teach there for 5 consecutive years. This program offers $5,000 in loan forgiveness for full-time, highly qualified elementary and secondary teachers. However, highly qualified full-time math and science teachers in eligible secondary schools can receive up to $17,500. The incentive program is contingent upon the state's definition of elementary and secondary, which has been unclear to educators across the state. Earlier this year, I was surprised when a colleague, Jamie Cooper, who is here with me today, informed me that she was declined the full amount because our state did not define middle schools as secondary schools. I, too, was planning on taking advantage of this program. At first, I thought this must be a mistake because the degree I hold is a Bachelor of Science in Secondary Education, and I'm certified to teach grades 6 through 12. Everything I've been told is K through 5 is elementary and 6 through 12 is secondary. After a few phone calls, I discovered, in fact, that Oregon does define a middle school for purposes of student loan forgiveness as an elementary school. When I called the Oregon Department of Education, I was informed this was a common frustration across the state, and that many other states in our country had already defined grades 6 through 8 as secondary or had changed their laws to accommodate this program. Now, after a few more phone calls and conversations with the right people wanting to make a change, here we are today in hopes of amending this law. The loan forgiveness program was intended to motivate highly qualified teachers to work in high-impact schools in the hope they would make a difference with the youth at those schools. However, as it stands, the incentive for highly qualified math and science teachers only applies to the high school level. I myself am endorsed to teach grades 6 through 12, but because I teach grade 8 and not grade 9 in Oregon, I cannot take full advantage of this program. I would not switch my last 4 years at Five Oaks Middle School for anything, and I'm very happy with my decision to remain, as well as the relationships I've built with my students. I believe that middle school is one of the most formative times in a young person's life. For students coming from impoverished homes, a middle school education, especially in math and science, provides the opportunity for them to empower themselves and break cycles of poverty and inequity. However, the work is very challenging, and given these high demands, Title I schools have a higher educator turnover rate. The loan forgiveness program addresses this by encouraging teachers to commit to teaching in an Oregon Title I or high poverty school for an extended period of time. With the passage of this bill, more and more math and science teachers will be inspired to help shape the young lives of our future scientists, doctors, engineers, and mathematicians who need them the most. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to us today. We are here to support Senate Bill 670, and it's truly an honor to be here to represent other middle school math and science teachers throughout the state. My name is Jamie Cooper, and I teach 8th grade math at Five Oaks Middle School in Beaverton School District, and I'm grateful for the introduction of this bill, and I'm hopeful that it will be passed. It will greatly impact Oregon's middle school math and science teachers and encourage highly qualified teachers to work in low-income middle schools. This is my sixth year working at Five Oaks Middle School in Beaverton School District. There are 1,096 students enrolled. 28% of them transfer between schools at least once in the school year. It's 60% free and reduced lunch. And I love my job, but it's mostly because the students that I work for really need my help. Despite their home lives, which for most are not ideal, every year students in my class make improvements in their academics and state test scores. Working under such unique circumstances is not for all teachers. There's an exceptionality within the needs of low-income students, which places an added toll on the educator. I work here because I feel like it's my calling to make a difference and that my students have a lot to gain. There's improvement needed in lessening their academic gaps so that they can have the same learning opportunities as other students throughout the state. I first learned about this loan forgiveness program while earning my undergrad in Atlanta, Georgia, while volunteering at a Title I school. So when I moved here and found out that I was working at Five Oaks Middle School, I was excited to find out that it also qualified for this loan forgiveness. My understanding of the law, you worked for 5 years and then applied. I did that. It also motivated me to get my graduate degree at Portland State sooner so that those loans could also be forgiven. So I'm excited. It's 2010. I get my master's degree in 5 years at the school. I turn in my application, and I return a letter. I receive a letter that states that I got some of my loan forgiveness, $5,000, but not the $17,500 that I was expecting. The letter stated that my teacher loan forgiveness application had been denied due to ineligibility. The Oregon Department of Education does not consider middle schools to be secondary schools for the purposes of teacher loan forgiveness. I was stunned. On the form, there were only two options, elementary or secondary, and I wouldn't have dreamed of checking the elementary box. I shared my letter with my colleagues who were also counting on this loan forgiveness, and we were all confused and felt misled. My colleague, Stephen Duvall, called the Oregon Department of Education and searched for the definition, and we found out that it does state that only secondary teachers, according to this definition, are high school teachers. So I'm glad that the language is under your scrutiny and that change is under your consideration so that other middle school math and science teachers can take advantage of this loan forgiveness program. This bill supports a program and encourages highly qualified math and science teachers to work in high-need schools and rewards those of us who would work in them anyway. On behalf of middle school teachers of Oregon and in these difficult times, we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us.
Well, we appreciate what you do, and I'm confident that we will make this change. We've been asking teachers to do a lot the last few years. I think this is an easy one for us. Questions? Comments? Senator Bonamici? Senator George?
Cindy, in these cases where... Thank you, Mr. Chair. In these cases where they've already made the application and they've been given a lower amount, are they going to be able to go back and reapply for that under this new definition?
Chair Haas, Senator George, we've sent inquiries to the federal government on this, and we've asked them point blank, in fact, we've submitted this bill, and they have not responded. What they've responded to us in the past, though, is we asked them, for example, could we have a policy at the Department of Ed that these guys were considered secondary, and they said, as long as your state law says, we need the state law to say. And so we believe that it would apply to retroactively, so to speak, to these teachers as well.
Follow?
Cindy, the only reason I say that is because I worry that we release this bill and then some of the people who have been affected.
Right.
Is there any language we could add that would strengthen our position that it's retroactive? Like saying, I mean, just want to make sure that before we release this bill and then these individuals who have made this application think, okay, I got it fixed. They make another application and then.
Right.
And then they go, is there any language that you can think of that we could make it to define it saying any application that was made prior to. You know, in 1990 would qualify, or 2000 or whatever, would be viewed under this definition. Would that strengthen our position? I just want to make sure we do it, that we don't leave these people hanging for something that they deserve.
Yeah, Chair Tass, Senator George, you know, it's a federal loan program,
mm-hmm.
and so we were viewing it as how do you define it in state law. I think what you're asking for is an applicability clause which would say something to the effect of that this definition would apply to those loans, you know, granted before or after the effective date of the act, something like that. And I don't think it would hurt. I don't know that it would help, but it wouldn't hurt, and it certainly would be clear.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. The only thing I worry about is that since we have one witness who's already made her application,
right.
and she's been granted $5,000, I would assume that the federal government would look at that case as being closed. I don't know the law, pertaining law to it. And all I'm saying is it would be nice if we just basically said for any of these applications that were made prior to, and I don't know when this program went into effect. What's that?
Around 1998, I think.
So we say any application made after 1998, this is the standard that applies for these loans, and at least we give them the strongest position possible to make sure we get that. And it's just an idea.
Chair Haas, Senator George, we're open to having this apply to as many teachers as possible, frankly. And so, I mean, we would be open to putting the language in. I'm not sure how the loan providers will view it. And so I'm reticent to make any promises, but we are open to having that kind of clear language in there if it may help someone or if it may help some of our teachers make the point to the loan providers. Definitely we'd be open to that.
I think we should look into it. It's a good point. I don't know that we certainly can't change the requirements at the federal level. And I don't know, I haven't looked at those requirements to find out if there are any restrictions on reapplying after one determination has been made. But I think it is worth looking into. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This has an emergency clause. I assume time is one
Sorry.
Of the issues here. Go ahead.
Senator Chair, I think... I've reapplied twice. I reapplied. I think what they do is they go and look at the log, and each time my denial letter says the Oregon Department of Education. So I'm planning that if the law changes to staple it to my third application and send it in. And, you know, and really at this point, it would be awesome for it to work for me. I'm sort of super excited that it's at this point and that the law will be applied to other people. But at this point, I'll take whatever chance I can get and turn the application. But it goes through so many different channels. When you apply, you send in your application to your loan provider, and then they send it to your loan guarantor, which is some invisible body somewhere else, that then processes it, talks to the State Department of Education, and sends it back to your loan company. And so there are a lot of other channels that it goes through. But I think if I attach a copy of the bill that says what we define, that they will look at it more closely the third time.
Yeah, I was going to suggest, Senator George, if it might be something to look at in the House as this goes through the system. You'll have a couple of weeks, and so maybe in an effort to be as timely as we can, pass it here, and then if this is something that we can add an amendment, do it there in the interest of time.
That works for me, Mr. Chair. There's many... we attempted to get as many of the Beaverton area legislators involved, and there's a lot of keen-eyed people on that who are co-sponsors, who I'm sure will be looking at this carefully.
Yeah, and this isn't just for Beaverton.
No, I understand. I completely understand that.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else interested in testifying on this bill? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 670 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 670.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 670 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 670 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 670 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Going down the line, I will carry this bill. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 670. It's too bad we're not working on commission today, because we're moving these bills right out. Okay, so are we at 21, 22,
22, 23?
Nope, a public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Linda?
Senate Bill 21 eliminates types of youth correction facilities at which youth may receive educational services under the Youth Corrections Education Program. It requires the Department of Education to be responsible for payment of education of certain youths in confinement. It requires the school district in which the youth is confined to be responsible for the education of the youth. It revises the method by which state school fund grants for youth corrections education program and the juvenile detention education program are calculated. It declares an emergency.
Okay, thank you. And we have Autumn Wilburn and Julie York from the department. Hi. Welcome.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Autumn Wilburn. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Education. Thanks for having us in front of you today to talk about Senate Bill 21, which is brought to you by the Oregon Department of Education. With me, I have Julie York, who, among other things that she oversees at the department, she also oversees the educational sides of YSEP and JDEP. We're going to lead with a little bit of background and then go into Senate Bill 21.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, as Autumn said, my name is Julie York, and I am the Director of Interagency Educational Services for the Department of Education. I am here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 21. This bill impacts the Youth Corrections Education Program, YSEP, and Juvenile Detention Education Program, JDEP. The Juvenile Detention Program provides education to youth held in county juvenile detention centers. The average stay for youth placed in these facilities is about 5 to 7 days, typically while awaiting adjudication. The Youth Corrections Program is established to provide a standard high school education to all eligible youth incarcerated in the Oregon Youth Authority closed custody correctional facilities. Since youth placed in these facilities are for much longer stays, these programs operate much like other high schools, except they are open year-round. The Department of Education contracts with school districts and ESDs to provide educational services to the youth in these programs. There are 10 youth correction programs and 14 juvenile detention programs under contract with the department. Senate Bill 21 has several critical elements. The first is to allow extended ADMW for youth corrections and juvenile detention education programs in a similar manner as available to districts with fluctuating enrollments. Extended ADMW allows a district to utilize the ADM of the current or previous year, whichever is greater. Allowing this option will provide more stability in the funding to these programs because students often move in and out of the facilities without a way for the programs to adjust or pre-plan accordingly. Since these programs are funded by the state school fund, this calculation for extended ADMW will help balance the funding and enrollment issues within these programs. The second feature of the bill places responsibility on the school district where the youth correction or juvenile detention facility is located to see that education is provided to students in both programs. This responsibility for education aligns to that of the long-term care and treatment statute. The department will continue to fund these services, but not be responsible for the education of the students should no one elect to bid for the contract to do so. Rather, it would be the school district in which the program is located. The school district themselves may decide to contract with another entity or choose to provide the services themselves. If the department is assigned the responsibility for education of these students and there are no parties interested in contracting to provide these services, the department would need to request staffing across the state to fulfill this need. This is a responsibility more appropriately assigned to local education entities. The committee also has the Dash 1 amendment in front of you today. The amendment does two things. First, it removes the request in weighted ADM for juvenile detention programs from 1.5 to 2.0. Second, it removes the request to eliminate types of youth correction facilities at which youth may receive educational services under the Youth Corrections Education Program. ODE first conceived of Senate Bill 21 out of a legislative concept in the spring of 2010. It originally included an increase of weighting for this program due to the small amount of funds generated through ADM for detention programs. A deeper analysis of the program indicates restructuring could eliminate the need for this increase in weighting given the current economic situation. Funding stabilization can be gained if the legislature approves the extended ADMW request contained within Senate Bill 21. The department, along with our partner in these programs, the Oregon Youth Authority, support Senate Bill 21 with the Dash 1 amendment. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have at this time about this bill.
Thank you, Senator Haas. I'm also available for any questions you might have.
Okay, Senator George.
So, obviously, we're talking about facilities like the one in Woodburn.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the response of the local school district there?
Senator Haas, Senator George, we have communicated with each of the school districts that currently have those, and we haven't had any folks express concern about those possibilities. I think in some look at it an opportunity to actually, get, when they're reducing potential staffing, that this could be an opportunity for them to use a portion of a ADM for a math teacher in another site, and it could benefit, but until it actually comes, because we still put out the contracts, and at this point in time, we haven't had someone not been in a situation where no one has wanted to contract for those services.
Thank you. Senator Moore?
Thank you. How are these youth educated now?
Chair Haas and Senator Morris, we contract with either school districts or educational ESDs, educational service districts, to provide that education. But if no one contracted the way the law is written currently, it would be ODE that would be going out and needing to come up with teachers to work in the programs.
So this measure would make it clear that it's the district's responsibility, not ODE's.
Chair Haas and Senator Morse, correct. I think a few years ago we did a very similar thing to the long-term care and treatment. It was also on the responsibility of ODE, and we made that change that school districts would be responsible. We currently still offer contracts in those programs, and in most, I don't think we found a situation there either where we haven't had either districts or ESDs that did not want to take the program.
Thank you. In the case of the Oak Creek facility in Linn County, that serves really a region, not just one school district. How would you approach that issue?
Senator Chair Haas and Vice Chair Morse, we currently, the current provider in going for contracts next year isn't interested, but we have three other providers who are already looking at taking over that facility. So at this point in time, we don't see that there's a concern. And we haven't heard from the school district saying, boy, this would be a huge issue if this were to go through.
Okay, thank you.
Was there a problem? Can you point to what has happened? What necessitated this proposal, this change?
Chair Haas, I think just given changes in contracts, I believe last year we did have some contractors that were concerned about whether they would continue with a contract in the future given their own cuts in their programs. But, and so as we looked at that, then what would happen, and knowing that that ultimately falls on the Department of Education, and were we the closest to what was going on in school districts to make those kind of decisions and provide that. And so, again, kind of look back at what we had done in long-term care and treatment and wanted to make this program similar, since it operates very similarly in that sense where we contract. We have been working with a work group since November, looking at some of the changes in these programs with restructuring, and so it has involved representatives from school districts or contractors and the both OYA and juvenile detention departments.
Further questions, comments?
If I may, so I have a better understanding, when you use the term contractor, who typically would that contractor be?
Chair Haas and Vice Chair Morse, the only ones who are eligible to contract currently are school districts or ESDs.
Okay. Thank you. That was my assumption, but I had visions of some other entity.
The Dash 1 amendment increases the weight from 1.5 to 2.0. Yes. No?
Decreases.
The Dash 1 amendment removes the request.
It removes the request. What was the reason for it?
Chair Haas, in going forward, given the economic situation, and I'm new to the department coming in and looking at how those programs operate, we felt we could do some restructuring of what the model looked like and reduce program costs accordingly.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. I have signed up Tori Lynn and David Cook. Land from the Linn County Juvenile Department and David Cook from Multnomah County Juvenile Department.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. David Cook, I'm with the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm the director of the Juvenile Services Division. I'm also representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association here today. I want to make a distinction. JDEPs, Juvenile Detention Education Programs, there are 14 juvenile detention facilities across the state, and they receive funding. ORS provides for year-round school in those facilities, and this is somewhat of a case of mistaken identity in terms of testifying against Senate Bill 21. We understood this was to be the vehicle whereby the Department of Education is proposing reductions in the length of the school year for incarcerated youth from 220 days to 176. We understand now that that will actually be addressed in an administrative rules hearing next week. We plan to oppose that next week, but wanted to bring that to your attention as well. Likewise, we do oppose the Dash 1 amendment. Since 2001, juvenile directors have been working with the Department of Education to increase the ADMW to 2.0 from 1.5. That would be consistent with what the Youth Correctional Education Programs, YSEPs, and the Oregon Youth Authority receive. The argument here is the same youth who are in juvenile detention are those youth who are in YSEPs. And if I may, the Donald Lee Longholm, our juvenile detention facility, is a regional facility that serves Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County youth. Educational services are provided to nearly 1,700 youth annually in that facility. 75% of those youth have special education needs, and the same 75% are on individual education plans. These are youth who are very high at risk, both of delinquency, but for the most part, they are not connected to schools when they come to us. This is their first opportunity to become reconnected with education. And the services provided in JDEPs, if you will, really help kids integrate back into school. In many instances, it's the first time that they've actually had a successful educational experience. And juvenile department staff, along with education specialists, work diligently to reconnect youth to their home schools once they're released from detention. And so I would just encourage you, as far as the Dash 1 amendments, we disagree with the Department of Education that restructuring would provide greater efficiency and be able to meet the needs of these youth. And although it's not within the bill, again, the administrative rule change, reducing the school year for incarcerated youth from 220 days to 176, I believe, is a mistake.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Tori Lynn. I'm the director for the Lynn County Juvenile Department in Albany, Oregon. Our department also has a juvenile detention center. It's a 20-bed detention center that serves both Lynn and Benton counties. Last year, we had 288 youth enter that detention center. Our average school attendance per day was just under 13 youth per day that were in school attendance. We provided over 15,000 hours of education for these kids. As Mr. Cook had, I think, eloquently said, the kids that we're dealing with, and testimony in the other bills that you heard today, I think, supports the kids that we're working with. This is the group of kids that is very difficult for our schools to handle. They're the kids that are disruptive. They're the kids that are disrespectful. They're the kids that have behavioral problems that typically get them kicked out of that mainstream school system. So when they come to us in the detention center, oftentimes they're on reduced days, maybe, you know, an hour a day of tutoring, sometimes not being in attendance of schools for weeks or months. And so when we get them into our detention center and they have the opportunity to be in a setting and experience some of that success, that's some really groundbreaking work for this group of kids. It gives them an opportunity, as Mr. Cook had said, sometimes for the first time in their academic life, to experience success in a school setting. It gives us the opportunity to build upon that when this youth is released. As you heard, Ms. York state, kids in detention stay from 5 to 7 days. That's, you know, our average is about 7 days in our detention center in Lynn County. We're not going to provide them with a diploma in 7 days. We're not going to provide them with, you know, 6 credits. What we are going to do is have them be re-engaged in the educational process. And I think, you know, that's the piece that's hard to define. That's the piece that's very difficult to put a number on. It's really, you know, kind of saving some of these kids from themselves. Often these kids come from, have really no social support. You know, they don't have education as a high priority or a value in their family system. Poor structure at home. They make their own bedtimes, as teenagers often will try to do. They don't have adults that support them in doing homework. And I can tell you from my own parenting experience of a middle schooler 2 years ago, a sixth grade science project that my daughter brought home, there is absolutely no way she could have completed that on her own and gotten an A. I spent probably 5 or 6 hours with her, probably longer than that over the course of a weekend of making sure she was typing it up and looking things up on the internet and doing those kind of things. The kids that we're talking about do not have those types of supports at home to be able to do that. They have a reduced ability to access technology. Maybe they don't have the internet at home. They don't have computers. So this group of kids comes with a lot of barriers. As I think Mr. Cook stated, the rule change, I think, is something that I would support being added to this bill regarding the reduction of days. Reducing 220 education days down to 176 may not sound like a lot, but it is a lot for this group of kids. It's huge. For example, if I took my numbers from 2010,
We provided 15,000 hours of education. With that reduction, that brings it down to about 12,000 hours, a difference of just about 3,000 hours of education that will not be provided to this group of kids. So I think that's an important piece that I think the committee should consider when addressing this bill. I don't believe that we have any strong opposition to the resident school district. I think that makes some sense, that if no contractors or people are bidding on the contract that are appropriate, the resident school district should be in charge of that school education program. I think we can agree with that. I think the opportunities that we have, as you heard from other testimony and other bills today, is that for adolescents, it's a time of brain development. It's a time when they can really flourish. It's also a time when they're extremely vulnerable. And we have the opportunity to reengage them in an educational process. When we look at the governor's balanced budget and the emphasis put on early intervention and how we can help kids grow to be stronger students, this is an opportunity where we could regain some of our students. Thank you.
Thank you. I completely understand sixth grade science projects. I'll tell you, the amount of time I spend with her homework makes me think that every hour I spend is how do these kids get by without parents. Questions or comments?
Senator Haas, if I may, I'd also like to add, there's a characterization that juvenile detention facilities only have kids from about 5 to 10 days. And while for the most part that's accurate, many juvenile detention centers, our facility included, house youth awaiting adjudication and trial on Measure 11 offenses. And about 30% of our population is made up of those youth. They are in custody anywhere from 90 days to a year. And so they look a lot like youth who are in youth correctional facilities. And so it's longer-term stay. And their benefit is even greater by being involved in education program while they are awaiting disposition of that matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it is nice to know somewhere in our system we have year-round education. We don't have fiscal reports on 21 or 22, even if we were ready and we're not ready. So if there's no one else to testify on this, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 21 and carry over Senate Bill 22 and open a public hearing on and work session on Senate Bill 23. And we have, can you give us a summary? Quick summary.
Yes. Senate Bill 23 changes the term second language to world language for purposes of elementary and secondary school education requirements, declares an emergency.
Autumn Wilburn.
Hello again, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Autumn Wilburn, Oregon Department of Education. Thanks for allowing me to come speak to you about Senate Bill 23, also brought to you by the Department of Education. So first, a little bit of background. The current term that we use in Oregon statute to describe language content areas other than English, for example, French, American Sign Language, Native American languages, is second language. This term's really no longer considered to be contemporary, and it doesn't reflect the verbiage that's used around the world to describe instruction and content standards related to various languages. Also, the term second language is often misinterpreted as a reference to second language learners. This has created several misunderstandings, which could be avoided in the future by revising this terminology. This change in terminology is especially important to members of language minorities, such as the deaf community. They communicate via American Sign Language, or ASL for short, which of course is not their second language, it is their first language. ASL was accepted as a second language for high school credit and college entrance requirements via this body, via Senate Bill 475 in 1995. Just a little bit of background. So Senate Bill 23 simply changes the term second language to world language in statute. The Department of Education views this as a housekeeping measure, and our Oregon Second Language Content and Assessment Panel supports this change. That is my overview of Senate Bill 23, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. And the reason we have to do this in statute is because it is in statute, second language versus world language.
Correct.
Senator Bonamici?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. And Mr. Chair, I can think of instances where you might have for example, a student who speaks Korean at home and speaks English and then is taking Spanish, which isn't her second language, it might be her third language. So it just doesn't make sense to have second language in the statute.
Further comments? Senator Shields? Okay. Okay, anyone else signed up? Testify or against, then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 23 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 23.
Excuse me?
Yes, sir.
I signed up on Senate Bill 23.
Oh. I'll reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 23. Okay. Sorry, we just got it. Mr. Wilner.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Robert Wilner, a sometime associate of the Confederation of Oregon for Language Teachers and with another organization devoted to strengthening the international dimension of Oregon education. Prior to that, I was in the U.S. Foreign Service for 25 years, which persuaded me of the importance of this perception among our people. I present a general comment here. I am concerned about this proposed change because I think the United States is possibly the only country in the world where you can graduate from high school without learning some language other than the native one you've grown up with. And it's been quite a struggle to get Americans to come to grips with that problem. And to come to grips with the fact that we're part of a much larger world in our own country. My experience in the Foreign Service persuaded me that's a very important issue. That's probably the most important issue we face in the world is at home. And I am deeply concerned that this bill might well give the impression that studying some language other than English is not an important part of your education. I don't understand the purpose of this proposed legislation, but I'm concerned that an unintended purpose of it may be to weaken the nation's commitment, certainly Oregon's commitment, to second language learning, which I think is crucially important. That summarizes what I have to say on this subject.
Well, I appreciate your comments. I don't know that the intent is to weaken the need for the ability to speak in other languages. Indeed, as Senator Bonamici pointed out, sometimes it's not second language, it's third language or fourth.
Language other than English may be the important factor, but I'm just concerned that when you say world language, well, is there any language other than English that's more of a world phenomenon? English is a worldwide language, but for most people, it's a second language. And I think that's a point of view that we sincerely need to take into account in planning education. I think that's basically what I have to say on this subject, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. Any questions or comments to Mr. Wilner?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
I just want to make a comment for the record that that I strongly support students taking languages other than English throughout their education and have been strong supporters of immersion programs and other programs that expose students to other languages, and that's not what I perceive to be the intent of this bill. So just to clarify that for Mr. Wilner, if I thought that this was going to send a message that we didn't think it was important for students to study another language, I wouldn't be supporting it. So I just want to make that perfectly clear that that's not the intent of this bill. And I think if you look at where it's used in the statutes, that will be clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. It raises an issue that I hadn't thought about, and that is we tend to look at things from our perspective as English speaking. What about those that are, in fact, second language learners in our system, and all the references to that, changing that to a world language? Does that represent confusion?
Just throwing that out.
We do recognize second language learners in our system, and they are not, English is not their first language.
Mr. Chair? If I may, it has been a while since I spent much time in the K-12 system, but it's my understanding, and there may be other people here from the Department of Education who can help. I believe that the term second language learners has now been replaced with English language learners, so that it recognizes that the students who are in our schools who are, for example, native Spanish speakers or native Russian speakers are learning another language, which is English. So I don't think that the term second language learners is used in the same context as it was. I believe it's been replaced with English language learners.
The statutes, reference second language. So we would be changing that to world language.
Yep. Well, thank you, Mr. Wilner.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 23. Pause on this one?
I'm fine with it.
This is, none of these bills today are pre-wired, so I'm happy to pause. Senator Shields?
I'm okay moving it.
I'm fine.
With taking a couple days?
No, I'm fine with moving.
You're fine?
I'm fine with the bill.
I don't feel strongly one way or the other on this, Mr. Chair. It just raises an interesting perspective. The statute is for example, in Section 3, existing language, school districts and charter schools shall offer instruction, and it lists those, and then it says second languages that meet the academic content. I'm okay.
All right.
I'm okay.
I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 23.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 23 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 23 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator George.
I just kind of looking at what Mr. Wilner commented on, I actually think that we're all coming to the same agreement. I think what the department's done is put in a definition that broadens and gives basically additional broadening, and so it recognizes English is being or is going to be taught, and then broadens it beyond there. So I think we're coming to the same conclusion as Mr. Wilner wants us to come to, and I think the department. The problem is we're taking a small snapshot of the statute and not looking in context. And so I'm comfortable with the bill the way it's written, that it's consistent with what Mr. Wilner even is advocating for, that it basically instructs our schools to make sure that we're teaching kids other languages so that we're better engaged in world commerce and trade in the world. So I think it's a step in the right direction, so I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 23 goes to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. We're down to Senator Morris. Would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Thank you all for your patience today. It was a good, thoughtful discussing a lot of these issues. We are adjourned.